And Judiciary. We're meeting June 2nd, 1987 at 3 p.m. in Hearing Room 343. Today we will have public hearing on House Bill 3374, 2954, 2734, 3013, 3197, 3191, and a work session on House Bill 2090, 1020, or Senate Bill 1020, Senate Bill 318, Senate Bill 454, Senate Bill 219, and Senate Bill 984.
The Judiciary Committee will come to order at 3:11. Senators Brenneman, Wires, and Fryer, Subcommittee of Three, to take public testimony on House Bill 2954. Representative McCarty, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Ron McCarty. I'm state representative from District 16. Mr. Chairman, this is what I call a two-minute bill versus a five-minute bill. You tell everything you know on the bill in 2 minutes or less. Well, essentially, it's going to be a 10-second explanation. If you look on lines 15 and 16, you will find the plaintiff shall be entitled to recover $500 or actual costs, including attorney's fees. This bill merely changes the figure from $200 to $500, which are reasonable costs, whichever is greater. It puts a cap on the amount. It is just bringing it up to a realistic figure. It's a very small bill, and I'd ask for your consideration on it.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your brevity very much. Any questions of Representative McCarty on this? I think that clearly is what the bill does.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Thanks for being here then. I guess we don't have any questions.
Thank you.
We don't have a quorum either.
What's the procedure from here? We have to...
Pardon?
Well, I'm just curious. What is the procedure from here? You have to have a quorum before you go.
Normally, we'd go into a work session.
Okay.
For a work session, and I can assure you that that will take place.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thank you for calling me first. Thank you.
You bet. You bet.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Wires.
As I've told you, Mr. Chairman, I have to go down to the Ways and Means to a meeting down there. And I'm sorry not to be here for your meeting. I know some of the people here are on a bill I'm particularly interested in, but I just have to go to that meeting.
All right, Senator Wires will be excused to
Thank
go to
you.
Ways and Means, and I'll make a note of House Bill 3013, and it's possible he might be back. I'll try to put that down a little lower on the agenda. Have to see how that comes out. Senator Brockman, by the way, is excused. Senators Cohen and Hill are still in the Business, Housing, and Finance Committee meeting where the titanic struggle between bankers and insurance companies is going on. So let's move to House Bill 3374. And Marilyn Koffel was here.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, since there's only one. Good afternoon. I'm Marilyn Koffel from the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I want to thank you for your consideration of 3374. I'm here on behalf of the commissioner today, and she believes that this fills a conspicuous gap in our tools that we have right now to fight public accommodation discrimination. Currently, the commissioner's empowered to file a complaint against places of public accommodation that post illegal signs or other means of communication. This authority has been on the books since 1969, but Commissioner Roberts has been the first labor commissioner to use it. I understand that the law's original purpose was to allow enforcement on behalf of black entertainers on tour who were not likely to stay in the state long enough to file a discrimination complaint and see it through the system. So the commissioner was empowered through the vehicle of a commissioner's complaint to take action on their behalf. The problem encountered by the Bureau has been the lack of any immediate and effective sanctions in the law, even if a commissioner's complaint is ultimately found to be valid. Aggrieved citizens may be reluctant to step forward or may not be found at all, even when, for example, there's a clear violation of the law that forbids signs refusing admittance to a public place to members of a particular race. without an individual complainant, the commissioner is unable to levy monetary penalties, which is often the only way to get a violator's attention and compliance. Prior to the hearing, then, our hands are effectively tied. If informal efforts to conciliate and achieve compliance have failed, illegal signs and racist displays can stay up and may become a catalyst for violence, as well as simply being an affront to all Oregonians. House Bill 3374 fills these two gaps. It allows a temporary cease and desist order before hearing, and it authorizes a civil penalty of up to $1,000 for each violation. In short, it provides a fast and effective response to public accommodation discrimination that is now lacking in the law. A recent case down at the Nodi Tavern has received quite a bit of attention, but it's still in the process. In fact, there was a hearing held yesterday in Eugene to which the respondent did not come. It's highlighted the gaps, and I think it's brought our attention to the fact that we need to remedy this situation, and that was the impetus behind the request for this bill.
You weren't surprised that the respondent didn't show up, were you?
No, we are not. I also understand that the OLCC closed him down several days ago, so I'm not quite sure where I think it's Mazenpahl is at the present time.
Well, no ties in my Senate district. We have a lot of independent individuals that live there, and a lot of them don't like the government in any form, so I'm
Senator Frey, I think that our staff members have realized that feeling in trying to deal with this particular individual.
Tell me what happened in the House. Was this in the House Judiciary Committee?
Yes, it did. It came out of the House unanimously, and it passed the House unanimously. There's been no opposition to the bill at all.
All right. Okay. Any questions? Thank you, Marilyn. Any other witnesses that happen to be here on House Bill 3374? If not, we'll close the public hearing on that. And I think I want to go to this. Okay, Mark. I told
Representative Campbell
would it probably be 4:15.
Two easy ones.
Okay.
Get to those people here.
Six are the easy ones. I tell you what. Can the page take a message to Representative Campbell's office that we're moving along here a little faster than I figured, and maybe if he wants to come over here in the next 10 minutes or so, why I'd take up his bill. We have a lot of folks here on that.
3197.
Take up House Bill 3191. We don't have any witnesses signed up on this. Anybody here interested in House Bill 3191? Council, tell the subcommittee what that's about, will you please?
Mr. Chair and Senator Brenneman, this bill would allow violations to be expunged. That's a procedure whereby records of convictions are erased from a defendant's record. Currently, Class C felonies and misdemeanors can be expunged, but violations cannot be. That's an inconsistency. This would extend the expungement to violations. It wouldn't upset the existing law, which prohibits expungements for traffic violations.
All right. Senator Brennan, would you have any questions of counsel on that?
Yeah. What kind of violations?
Violations are one step below misdemeanors. So, for instance, a criminal trespass is a misdemeanor, but an attempted criminal trespass is a violation. A violation can only be penalized by a fine without any jail time and doesn't require the appointment of counsel. Also has a lesser standard of proof, preponderance of the evidence, rather than beyond a reasonable doubt.
Okay. Senator Brennan, do you have any other questions of counsel at this point?
None of this.
All right. We'll close the work session or the public hearing on House Bill 3191. And let's see. All right, let's take up House Bill 2734. State Police, Bob Lane's here. Come on up.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Lane, Oregon State Police Fish and Game Enforcement Division. In essence, what this bill will allow our state police game officers and our cadets to issue citations to vehicles found abandoned or parked in road closure areas. Currently, they're faced with a dilemma of waiting for the return of the hunters or ignoring the violation altogether and going about other routine patrols. This is a very similar bill to Senate Bill 746, except that one pertains to wildlife, one pertains to motor vehicles. The language in Senate Bill 746 is certainly more explicit as it relates to the procedures to follow once the citations have been issued. And we support the bill.
All right. Now, Senator Brennan may recall...
we had this in another committee.
Yes, that's right. You had it in the Ag Committee, and it came to the floor, and they sent it to this committee. And counsel, I think, will... are those amendments prepared yet, counsel?
Yes. Mr. Chair and Senator Brenneman, the amendments, -1 amendments, are in the file. What they do is take the procedural provisions of Senate Bill 746 and incorporate them into House Bill 2734. So it basically provides the same procedures and protections, would allow a law enforcement officer to leave the citation on the vehicle.
Don't have that amendment.
It's on the back, Senator, it's on the back of the staff measure. Staff measure.
Oh, okay.
Staple on the back. Senator Hamby, we are on House Bill 2734.
This one we had an ag.
Oh, yes.
That they sent from the floor back
That's
up
right.
here to our committee.
That's right.
And council has prepared the amendments to meet the deficiencies that I called the Senate's attention to earlier. And so...
The amendments would allow the law enforcement officer to leave the citation on the vehicle without actually seeing the violation. There would be a presumption that the registered owner is responsible. The registered owner would have the opportunity to come to court and argue as a defense, it wasn't me. It would be an affirmative defense by the registered owner. If the registered owner didn't appear in court on the date that the citation directs, then the court would send a certified letter to the address of the registered owner to make sure that we get them the second time around. So, again, this incorporates all the provisions of the bill that we passed out, 746, into this bill.
All right, any questions of Captain Lane?
I'll move the amendment.
We don't have a quorum. We don't have a quorum.
That's right.
You do that. Okay, thanks very much, Captain. And Senator Hampton, what? We have we've gone through, this will be the fourth bill we've gone through already.
I apologize.
That's all right, because I think you'll find when you take a look at, we've gone through 2954,
mm-hmm.
3374,
mm-hmm.
Is that just the third one we just had?
3374, 2954, 3191, 2734.
Okay.
I think that Senator Brenneman would concur that there wasn't too much controversy generated.
Not too much. Not too much
by any of those. Okay, now Representative Campbell is here, and we'll go to a public hearing on House Bill 3197. And I'm pleased to have my neighbor and constituent, Representative Larry Campbell, here to lead off on this. And you can come up by yourself or with anyone else you want, of course.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I thank you very much. I'm Representative Larry Campbell, 43rd District. Fortunate today to have the chairman of the committee be my senator. I'm going to start by myself, Bill, because I have two groups of folks who want to testify, and there's three in each group, and it would be appropriate if I just introduce the groups, and then the two groups will come up. I'm here this afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, to voice my support for House Bill 3197, and I want to thank you very much for hearing this bill. 3197 was introduced by the Committee on Judiciary, and the first portion of that bill was a judiciary bill from the House, and they were kind enough to amend the grandparents' visitation rights into that bill. So the portion that I'm most concerned about, although I'm supportive of the entire bill at this point in time, the portion, of course, that I'm most concerned about is that that relates to grandparents' rights. In essence, the legislation should be called Children's Rights Bill as much as Grandparents' Rights Bill, because the children will benefit tremendously from an increase in contact with grandparents, and particularly in those situations where the grandparents have been shut out, as some of the cases that I'll be referring to have been. In a child's life, as you well know, there are three major relationships which have major influence on those lives. That's parents and teachers and grandparents. And all of these are unique in their own way, with grandparents providing a unique source of love and support, while many times other influential people set high expectations for children, the grandparents are always there with a special unconditional love that only grandparents can provide. Currently, there are factors at work in our society that are changing the very foundation of the family. Such societal changes as high divorce rates and increased number of two-wage earner households are among those that are contributing to these problems. As more and more children are raised in less and less stable home environment, the more important it is to develop a strong relationship and a strong and continuous relationship between the child and the grandparent. Although it's a children's rights bill, there are certainly benefits to grandparents as well. Grandchildren are a wonderful part of a grandparent's life. I think for those of you who have grandchildren, you can relate to the joys of having them. For the rest of us, we can only hope and observe that the happiness that comes from others from that relationship. The bill will benefit many grandchildren who are suffering because they are precluded by their parents from seeing their grandparents. Many reasons exist for these problems, including jealousy from one parent or both, or disgruntled custodial parents, and of course there are some other reasons as well. Currently, there exist laws on the book that allow grandparents to petition the courts for visitation rights. However, the law only benefits a narrow group of grandparents and excludes many others. House Bill 3197 is designed to expand the law so that a broader group of grandparents have these same petitioning rights. I might mention that the House committee removed from House Bill 3197 before they sent it to you step-grandparents, and that's one of the things that I would ask that you look at as you consider this bill. Currently, Oregon...
Just a minute, Larry. Let me interrupt you. Could you
go right ahead.
Can you kind of state in your own words by way of summary how your proposal would differ from the current statutory language in terms of grandparents' right to petition for visitation? You said that this apparently would broaden the group somewhat. Can you explain that?
Yeah, what we have now in the law is that you can apply to the courts during divorce proceedings or after a final decree has been entered to in a divorce proceeding and after the death of a parent of a minor child, but only in those cases, only where the parent of the deceased parent is involved, the grandparent is involved. What our bill will basically do, Bill, is it will give those grandparents who have been shut out, even by their natural children, from contact with their grandchildren. I'll give you an example. We have a case where a couple has told the grandparents that they could visit their children if they would deed a portion of their farm to them. We have another case where the parents have told the grandparents that if they buy them a car, they would allow them to see their grandchildren. And so these are cases where we have specific individuals that are denied the ability to see their grandchildren because of, in essence, I guess you could say, blackmail. So what our bill really does is it allows those people to petition the court and establish those rightful contacts. As I mentioned, this bill, the way it reads right now, excludes step-grandparents. And I think you're going to hear some testimony from Jim Ferguson and ARP folks regarding that particular aspect of the bill.
Now,
and,
you'll recall, go ahead.
I was just going to say that I have six folks with me today, who each have a story of their own, and they recognize they have very little time. In fact, they won't take as much of your time as I have. But I would like very much for you folks to listen to their stories and draw your own conclusions about the importance of this bill. And they're Dolores Berard of Portland, Maxine Bush of Lincoln City, June Foy of Portland, Hardy Cave of Portland, Dwayne and Sylvia Richardson from Junction City, and Jim Ferguson of Portland, who's a past member of the ARP Legislative Committee. And so with that, Mr. Chairman.
I didn't want to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, that's perfectly all right. I recognize
all
right. Time is.
Well, that's all right. We, we'll take the time that's necessary. I just had another question. And that was, one concern that this committee has heard expressed before is that the concern over where the parents have, you know, a genuine reason to not want contact between the children and their parents. There are those situations out there, you know, and this would still, your bill would allow the court to take into consideration any factors that might actually be adverse to the best interests of the child, or I guess what I'm asking you, this doesn't tell the court that just because you're a grandparent, you're going to be absolutely entitled to visitation, does it?
Absolutely not, Mr. Chair. In fact, the committee on the House side tightened the bill down to the point of saying that the grandparent would only be able to petition the court if they've established or have attempted to establish ongoing personal contact with the child. And then the determination is strictly up to the court. But at least this will give the grandparent an opportunity to have their story heard and someone who is not emotionally involved make a decision.
All right. Then I think my staff has provided you with some analysis of the bill. Have you seen that yet?
No, I haven't.
Well, go ahead, counsel.
Mr. I think Chair, one of my staff members
Campbell,
has.
One of your legislative assistants has a copy of my memo. The memo relates primarily to the psychological parent aspects of the bill, which not really part of Section 2. But one aspect of the bill and
Excuse me, counsel, before you proceed. Senators, do you have that
yes.
in front of you? All right, go ahead.
I'll give you a copy of the proposed Section 7.
Would you have an extra copy of your memo, counsel, or not?
I think Representative Campbell's legislative assistant has one there.
He covered me on this before, and I think it has an effect on step-grandparents and does not involve Section 2, which is the portion of the bill that has been amended into this bill for our purposes, for the grandparents' purposes.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Hamby.
Larry, can you tell us what was the objection with the House Committee to the step-parent language?
Well, there seems to be an objection to broadening the scope to any degree. In fact, this amendment, as I read it, really tightens the restriction to an even greater degree than the House version, which I accepted because it looked like it was the only way we were going to get a bill. But if I read this appropriately, it maintain an ongoing personal relationship with substantial continuity for at least 1 year through interaction, championship, interplay, and mutuality. We've got cases here where a grandparent has a one-year-old grandchild and parents have never allowed them to see them. And we've got cases here where that specifically is the thing that we're aiming at. This amendment, and I don't know where it came from, but this amendment basically would destroy the very thing that we're after.
Mr. Chair.
Counsel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Campbell. The amendment relates to a specific class of persons. The bill addresses psychological parents on the one hand and grandparents on the other hand.
Okay.
Psychological parents may only, in order to get either custody or visitation, they have to meet the rigorous requirements that are set forth on page 2 of the amendments.
I apologize. This is not related to the grandparents.
No. Correct. But, however, it would, in lieu of replacing the step-grandparents in the statute, this would give a limited opening for step grandparents to petition the court. The requirements would be more substantial than a grandparent because they'd have to show the requirements set forth in that amendment. But if they did show those requirements, they would be eligible for visitation as well as other persons.
We think that that would come closer to what you're aiming at than what it is now, actually.
Well, so from a step-grandparent standpoint, it would.
That's right.
And on the grandparent side, as great leniency as we can have, with the court, of course, being in a position of having to make that decision, would be helpful. I am sorry I reacted the way I did, but I misunderstood where this would go in the bill.
Okay.
And we are, as you know, I've already fought the battle regarding giving grandparents the opportunity to apply to the court for this right, understanding that some of them never even seen their grandchildren.
All right. Yes, Council, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Campbell, just to clarify one point. Under existing law, after the divorce decree, grandparents of the custodial parent, or that is, the parents of the custodial parent, are ineligible to apply for grandparents' visitation. What this bill would do is allow the petition to be requested by either set of grandparents.
Any other questions of Representative Campbell?
Then I'd like the first three folks that are going to testify to come up and take
you bet.
My place. And thank you again very much for hearing.
That would be Dolores Brard and Maxine Bush and June Foy.
My name is Dolores Brard. I'm from Portland. And my husband and I have two grandchildren and a new grandchild due any day now, and we're not allowed to see them.
Now, these are the children of your daughter or your son?
My daughter.
Yes, sir.
We have not had them in our home. We've never had them visit us overnight or come for dinner. They haven't been to family picnics. They have little cousins that they haven't met. Up until March of this year, we had a limited relationship with them in that we were allowed, if we contacted the parents ahead of time and they were in the proper mood, we were allowed to deliver presents, such as birthday presents or Christmas presents or things like that. In March, when we attempted to deliver a birthday present, we went about it the wrong way, and that we were told that we were just simply not allowed to see the children. And we do not fall under the present requirements of the present bill because this is not a case where a marriage is being dissolved, and it's not a case where there's a death of a parent. We're simply just not allowed to see our grandchildren. And childhood is a very, very short time. Our oldest grandchild is now 7, and the second one is 5. And it would be very nice if we could at least have a chance to have an opportunity to see them while they're still children.
Could I ask you, Ms. Brard, has this situation existed as long as the children have been alive, or is it just something that's come up recently?
It's existed even before the first child was born. I mean, it was obvious to us during the first pregnancy that this sort of thing was going to happen. And we have attempted to talk to the parents, and they simply turn away. We have asked them to come to counseling with us, and we have offered to pay for it. We have used every resource that we could think of to get some sort of dialogue going. We have simply been turned away and no reason giving. It's just, we don't want you.
Was your daughter estranged from you before
she
got married?
No, we were exceptionally close.
And but not only do you not see the grandchildren, but apparently you do not visit even with your daughter. Is that it?
No, I have attempted many times to talk to her and say, can we not get together and work on this? And the answer is always, well, we'll see, but there is never any response beyond that.
All right, any questions, Ms. Berard? All right, fine, go ahead. Who's next?
Oh, I'm Maxine Bush, a resident of Lincoln City and a member of the Association of Retired Persons, and have enjoyed the role of a grandparent for 26 years. Grandparents' visitation rights, an issue the members of ARP have wholeheartedly supported for the past 5 years. The ARP State Legislative Committee, acting on behalf of our statewide memberships, endorsed such a bill in 1985. As you know, we lost it. We need a balanced statute, one that will provide step-grandparents as well as maternal and paternal grandparents equal opportunity to seek visitation rights. 1985 statistics show an estimated 1 million children a year experience divorce of their parents. 59% of all marriages end in divorce. Many, and I repeat, many of today's children are born out of wedlock by cohabitating parents who subsequently separate. The latter is a position not presently addressed in existing statutes. There are over 462,000 persons in Oregon over 60. This does not include the number of grandparents in their 40s or 50s. And the national figures state that over 75% in that age group are grandparents. Grandparents' importance to the family increases during times of crises, at which time they become mediators of anxiety and tension and fill the child's need for
a stepfather and then filed.
He was a stepfather to one and the real father to the other one.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Helps me.
My husband and I took the children to church, and we'd sit up with them at night when they were ill and sat with them in the hospital when one little girl was taken to the hospital. I was the only maternal influence in the girls' lives. The mother left when one child was 8 months old and the other little child was 3 years old. And even to today, there is no maternal parent in that home. There is no woman to see to the needs of these little children. These little girls were very emotionally upset and needed this one-to-one contact that my husband and I could provide for them, and we felt it very important to be a part of their lives. The stepfather took this right away from us, so I petitioned the court under the psychological grandparent to get the right, just the right, to see my grandchildren, that I could have, my husband and I could have the privilege of having a designated time that we could see these little children. And when we went to court, we qualified for all of the requirements, but was denied the right to see these children under the psychological law. And I feel that it should be changed because we feel the importance of having these little children, and we think it's important that they need this nourishment and this one-to-one contact that a grandparent has with these little children. And we wish that this law could be changed because we feel that it's important that these little children have the same rights and the same benefits that their parents had of having this love and this companionship.
Any questions of Mr. Romberg? Senator Cohen.
If we broaden the psychological parent, and I need to look more carefully at that, wouldn't that strengthen the stepfather's position originally? And not necessarily, I'm confused by the expanse of the bill that deals with issues beyond just grandparents. And I want to know from you whether, if you've looked at the other parts of the bill, which in fact, is, in my judgment, would give more a broader kind of authority to the stepfather at this point. As well.
Um, Well, as I, the way that we, my husband and I feel were, was the fact that we had the children every weekend. We fulfilled all of that. We had them from Friday night until Monday night, so we had them quite a bit. The one little granddaughter, we paid to have her brought up here from Phoenix, Arizona, and she lived with us for 6 months. He denied us the right to see these little children just because of his anger. It wasn't that he had anything against us as parents or as grandparents.
Okay. Yeah. No, I just need to cogitate on other parts of the bill. I agree with you from your standpoint, and I'm trying to figure out how the other parts of the bill relate to your...
Senator Cohen, yeah. Is that something council can respond to?
All right. That's all. I just want to know whether she was aware of it and whether that was part of your understanding, but I'll figure that out. Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, let me try to clarify Mrs. Ramberg's situation because I think it has relevance to the bill. Her situation fell within a hole both under the present law and the proposed law. Her son was the natural father of one of the children. His paternity was never acknowledged. Therefore, under existing law and the proposed law, she is not legally a grandparent and doesn't fall within grandparents' rights under existing or the proposed law. This current psychological parent definition is on the amendment on page 2, lines 8 to 10. It's a strict standard. Proposed standard's even stricter. It requires a relationship that continues on a day-to-day basis. Now, in court, despite the fact that the court found weekend visits over a period of several years and a continuous period of physical custody of 6 months, the court said that it wasn't really day-to-day. And because the statute, both under existing law and proposed, makes no distinction between those psychological parents that seek custody and those that merely seek contact or visitation, the court found there was no standing in this particular case. So Mrs. Ramberg falls in a hole in the statute as a psychological parent that comes close to but doesn't meet the day-to-day requirement, as a grandparent where the paternity has never been established. The proposed amendment attempts to deal with that problem, but it's a gap in the current law.
All right. Thank you for being here. Julie McFarland, please.
Chairman Fry, members of the committee, I'm Julie McFarland. I'm a staff attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project. The Juvenile Rights Project supports House Bill 3197, and I have submitted some written testimony to you that I'm not going to go into. What it does is lay out some of the case law that has established the important constitutionally protected rights that are involved in some of the relationships at issue in this bill, and also some of the sociological literature that has established the importance and the benefits that are obtained by children from such relationships and the harms to children who are separated from grandparents and other relatives with whom they have established these important relationships. I want to tell you just briefly that this bill works fine in the Multnomah County Juvenile Court, and we haven't had any problems with it. It's been a really beneficial law.
Senator Cohen.
When you say this bill, you mean the current bill that you're proposing or the current law?
The current law.
Okay, the current law works fine in Multnomah County. When you say this bill, I don't.
That's right.
I want to find out what you mean. Okay. Thank you.
We've had a number of these cases in my office. I've handled 5 personally. 4 of them involved grandparents who had essentially been parents to their grandchildren, or the parents were totally or nearly totally out of the picture. 1 involved a foster mother. All of the grandparents ended up getting custody as a result of the juvenile court proceeding. The foster parent withdrew her petition. And in all 4 grandparent cases, it was a really good thing that the court had the ability to grant this grandparent standing to come in and tell the court about the relationship, because without that ability, the court would not have known about the depth of the relationship involved and probably would not have maintained that relationship. The bill, the original proposed bill, does two things, and that is to clarify that the law does apply in juvenile court proceedings. I understand that this has been a problem in some counties. It also adds a provision for temporary custody, which I think is important and has been problematical in some cases. I participated in, was invited to and participated in the negotiations that resulted in most of the House amendments, and I did agree to those amendments. That would not include the grandparents' rights amendments that are at the end of the bill. I also have reviewed Mr. Kramer's proposed amendments, and with the caveat that I previously agreed to the form of the bill as it's submitted, I think that his suggestions 1 through 4 are very good and help to clarify what might raise questions about the bill, and I would take no position on number 5.
Any questions of Ms. McFarland? Okay, thank you for your usual good work on this, your interest. Okay, let's Judge Norblad and Margie Sherman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm Margie Sherman, Secretary for the Committee for Oregon Families. House Bill 3197 was introduced originally, as Ms. McFarland just testified, to clarify 3 particular points. One was whether or not it applied clearly in juvenile court, the temporary custody issue, and then to delete language which is on lines 17 and 18 on page 1 of the amendments regarding dissolution proceedings. When the bill was in the House Judiciary Committee, we were asked to meet with the Children's Services Division and others to address concerns that were addressed by our bill, as well as a bill that was introduced by former Representative Darlene Hooley. Representative Hooley's constituent problem was more of a harassment nature, and we all met together and came up with the language that you see in Section 1 of the amendments. Then as the bill progressed through the committee, it kind of became the grandparents' visitation rights, and I wanted to take credit for the 49-0 vote on the House side, having been originally the only lobbyist on the bill, but quickly found myself surrounded by a lot of other folks. The Committee for Oregon Families does not take a position on the grandparents' rights portion of the bill. It's not why the bill was introduced, as far as we are concerned, so we are neither opposed nor disapprove of those amendments. I did meet with Mr. Kramer and went over his amendment concerning the issues that he raises, and I believe that items 1 through 4 are quite reasonable and clarify the situation. His problem number 5 solution, I believe, broadens it to such an extent that we get back to the problem that was addressed, why we tightened up the child-parent relationship to begin with in the amended bill, that then an awful lot of people, including daycare providers, et cetera, could go in and make Judge Norblad a little busier to file for visitation rights. So I do have some concerns with his language on that, but I did submit written testimony, which I won't bore you with further, and I think Judge Norblad probably has some additional comments.
Judge Norblad?
Al Norblad, a Marion County Circuit Judge, member of the Committee for Oregon Families. And I might add, the initiator of the original bill in regards to this, when it was first introduced in the last legislature, I think she's done an outstanding job of testifying. There are a few problems. Some courts think it doesn't apply to juvenile, very few, but I think that needs to be taken care of and they need to be included. Clearly, we forgot to include temporary care. And if you have a parent that's deceased or something of this nature, the child has to be temporarily placed someplace. That needs to be taken care of. CSD had some concerns about foster parents trying to go around the adoption law and trying to get children this way. I think this clears up and solves CSD's problems and the fact that it limits foster care people making application. They must have a continuous relationship. I think it's for 3 years. So I think this is very important, and I think it needs to be worked on and cleared up. As she said, in regards to the grandparents, we've taken no position. In fact, today was the first day I've seen it. And I think Mr. Kramer's amendments 1 through 4 certainly make it clear. But I have questions. I personally, not testifying from the Committee of Oregon Families, but I personally have questions on the last amendment and the foster care part, and I certainly hope that the clearing up of this bill is not affected by the feelings over the grandparents or the that last section.
Any questions? Senator Hamby, did you have a question?
I was not aware that it was such a significant problem that foster parents wanted to adopt children that had been placed in their home, and that that was bad in some way, that we didn't want foster parents adopting them.
I don't think that's the point that CSD is concerned about. There are regular channels that they can go through to do that, through the regular adoption procedures that everybody does. And
now would not...
And this would circumvent that. And what CSD wants them to do is to follow the regular adoption procedures, and that's simply what it does.
I didn't understand.
Yeah. Adoptions, put it very, very bluntly, there aren't enough kids. We don't have enough people having children out of wedlock and not keeping them. They all seem to come into my court at the age of 16 wanting being emancipated so they can collect welfare on their own. People want to have nice, standard children. There aren't that many of them. None of them are being put up for adoption. Families are now quite small. I would strongly suggest you look at the Statesman Journal or the Oregonian under the friendship ads in the front of the want ads. There's always four or five people advertising in there, I want your child. So people will do lots of things to get children now, because there just simply aren't that many to be adopted.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Counsel.
Judge Norblad, in the situation of a step-grandparent, a grandparent in which paternity has not been established, so a person's not legally the grandparent, or a situation of an aunt or an uncle that steps in for a long period of time to deal with an incapacitated or incompetent parent who then wants to continue, not custody, but some regular contact with the child. Apart from the solution that I propose, can you think of any way to deal with the gap in the legislation?
I really can't. The problem is that's so broad that it would include teachers, it would include daycare providers, it could almost include anybody. Initially, the grandparent, and I was involved in the initial grandparent legislation, the purpose of that was to take care of cases where the non-custodial parent no longer lives in the area, and that's, therefore the non-custodial grandparent does not get visitation. That was the sole purpose for the initial legislation. Obviously, the legislature, in looking at this, has extended the policy that the government shall get involved in parent-child-grandparent relations and extend visitation there. And I don't know how you're going to be able to limit it to that, but it just keeps expanding it and keeps expanding it in every legislator. And I've had one case where it got absolutely ludicrous. The kid would never have spent a single weekend at home if everybody that was petitioning for visitation rights, if I had given them.
Anything further?
No, I just have some concern about not being able to, or somebody not being able to sort of take a real look at the whole visitation question, opening up so wide that you have people who go that route when they don't do other route, you know, when they don't qualify or they're not suitable.
And that's one of the things that was initially done in this legislation when it was originally passed, is that if they don't meet these requirements, this is one of the few pieces of legislation that directs the court to dismiss it. In other words, says that it is demurrable if you don't meet these standards, and therefore it ought not be heard in an attempt to get rid of spurious hearings.
Okay, thank you both. And Karen Pearson, please.
My name is Karen Pearson. I'm representing Children's Services Division. Thank you for hearing this bill. I have provided written testimony, and I think that rather than take your time, I would just ask that it be made part of the record and say that our agency does support House Bill 3197 as amended by the House, and particularly we support the changes that are being made in Section 1 that amend ORS 109-119. And I did talk to counsel about the proposed amendments, and I think we have serious concerns with number 5 for basically the same reasons that Judge Norblad already discussed. It, for our agency, we could see lots of problems for children who are involved in the juvenile justice system, the juvenile court system, in that they would be spending the majority of their time in court over a visitation proceeding or visiting someone. I have no problem with the other areas that he discussed except number 3. And I do believe to hold good faith with Representative Hooley's office, who was part of negotiating the amendments to Section 1, that the situation that her constituents brought to her were those of other people who were residing in the house with a custodial parent. For instance, in our day and age, we have live-in girlfriends, boyfriends, etc. And they, her constituents were experiencing harassment from people filing. In essence, they were kind of nuisance proceedings, then backing out. But meanwhile, the constituents had to hire an attorney, prepare to defend themselves, go through all the stress of fighting a custody and visitation battle with those sort of people. I believe that it might be a considerable problem for people in domestic relations court. I don't know that it would be of any major consequence to us. In terms of Section 1, the grandparents' bill, I don't know that we particularly take a position on it. It, as far as it impacts us, it parallels our own administrative rules for grandparents, and I feel quite positive about it myself. Okay. Are there any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Council.
Ms. Pearson, do the administrative rules address step-grandparents?
We don't distinguish. I do think that we've had at least informal opinion from the Attorney General's office that once a marriage is dissolved, no, we had a formal opinion that once a marriage is dissolved, there isn't such a thing as a step-parent. So that might be, I would assume, secondarily that would also affect a grandparent. They would no longer have a legal relationship. So it wouldn't, if there was a death, they would, there would still be a step grandparent, I assume.
Senator Hamby.
Mr. Chair, I don't think I even want to ask about a surrogate mother or a surrogate. No, regarding rules.
Okay. All right. Thank you. All right. Well, let's see. Now, that'll close the, I think I covered everybody here. The we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3197. And is there anyone here on House Bill 3191? All right. Counsel, for the record, why don't you just tell the subcommittee about 319? Is that yours?
No,
3191?
Oh, yes, it is.
3191. Just tell us about that, please. Well,
Mr. Chair, I think we've dealt with that previously. That's the expungement of violations.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. That's right. That was. Oh, that's right. All right. So we're down to House Bill 3013. Okay. Julie McFarland, come back up, please.
Members of the committee, I'm Julie McFarlane. I'm a staff attorney with the Juvenile Rights Project. This bill was introduced at our request, and the chief sponsor, Representative Bauman, has been called and is on her way over to join us in presenting this bill to you. I also have asked Judge Norblad to join me for these introductory comments on the bill. Judge Harrell has asked me to submit to you, and I have submitted a copy of his written testimony from the House side, and that should be in your materials. He had planned on testifying on the bill, but had to go to Reno this week and was not available. This bill amends the statute which governs juvenile court disposition and review hearings, ORS 419-507, in two places to make it clear that the juvenile court in such hearings has the authority to specify the particular type of care, supervision, and services that Children's Services Division must provide, and in cases where a child has been placed inappropriately by CSD. The bill also allows the juvenile court to specify an appropriate type of placement. With the House amendments, the bill clearly leaves the actual planning and provision of services as the responsibility of Children's Services Division. The juvenile system has not infrequently been accused of doing more harm than good and subjecting children to the worst of both worlds. We have seen the need for the juvenile court to have the authority to make specific orders in a small percentage of cases. Although small in number, these cases tend to be extremely difficult cases where if intensive treatment is not provided while the child is young, the child is likely to be institutionalized and a burden on society his entire life. Most often these are cases where the worker just has not done adequate casework, and there are a number of reasons for this. I think the primary reason is that caseworkers in Oregon are just extremely overloaded. They have case loads that are 2.5 times the national rate for caseloads. Sometimes it is because the caseworker is overwhelmed by the degree of difficulty of the case. The children involved are displaying extremely difficult behaviors to try to make a case plan for and find treatments. And let's face it, no system is perfect. Sometimes the caseworker just is lazy, inadequate, inadequately trained, or inadequately supervised. In my experience with these cases, they are most often like the In Re L case that I have included in your materials. They are cases where there is actually a plan and an agreement on a plan between the court and CSD, but there's not adequate follow-through in then providing the services that are in the plan. It is rather unusual in my experience for the court to actually be taking on the development of a case plan. Whatever the reason, the needs and rights of the child and society require that the juvenile courts, which do in fact oversee CSD, have the authority to order that these services be provided. Without the clarifications made by this bill, CSD has substantially unfettered discretion in whether to provide services and treatment. Such unfettered discretion is not only harmful to children and their families, it is also inconsistent with the strong legislative trend toward more oversight of CSD by the juvenile courts. In recent years, the legislature has imposed many duties on the juvenile court in its efforts to protect children whom the courts have committed to the care of Children's Services Division. The legislature has given children a statutory right to treatment, has given the court the duty to protect the best interests of the child. The legislature has permitted the court in 419-507 to require CSD to prepare and submit to the court a treatment plan. The legislature has given the court continuing jurisdiction to protect the rights of the child and the parents. The legislature has required the juvenile court to review the cases and case plans and monitor services being provided by Children's Services Division in cases before the court at numerous intervals. Those reviews can be conducted whenever the child, parent, or juvenile court basically wants a review. And even if no one wants a review, those reviews must be conducted periodically, as often as every 6 months. The legislature has also created citizen review boards as an arm of the juvenile courts. The citizen review boards conduct reviews and of cases to provide oversight and monitoring. They themselves have no authority, and their only authority is what they gain through the court by making their recommendations to the court. And this session, the legislature may create court-appointed special advocates, which also will oversee and monitor CSD, among other things, and report to the court, not having any authority of their own. Thus, it is clear that there has been much movement in the direction of fettering CSD's discretion. Most of that movement has placed the juvenile court in a monitoring role over CSD. These legislative changes have cost the state substantially